Welcome back. It's the third hour of Issues Etc. In the first few minutes of this hour, we'll be addressing the issues that have been raised. Well, they've been raised for quite some time now. People who have been watching the present Pope, Pope John Paul II, have for a long time realized that this is a man of obvious longevity and impact in the history of the Church. The longevity is the thing that has people wondering nowadays, because as of the 14th of March, he will be the second longest tenured pontiff in the history of the Church, second only to, let's see, Pope Pius IX, who reigned from 1846 to 1878, 31 years, 7 months, 21 days. Now, in those days, they probably did not speak of papal term limits, but they are talking about it now. In fact, even Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, Dean of the College of Cardinals, has suggested that that might be something the Church could consider in the future. Well, we're going to talk with Dr. James Hitchcock about papal term limits. He's professor of history at St. Louis University for the first 15 minutes. Then, for the remainder of the hour, Uwe Simonetto joins us for our regular religion roundup. He's religion editor of United Press International. Several of the things we'll be talking about with Uwe, the logic of gay weddings. We'll also be talking about some recent Barna research that says spiritual activity is up, although the nature of that spiritual activity that's up is rather interesting, and some other things with Uwe Simonetto of United Press International. Dr. James Hitchcock, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much. Always glad to be here.
Dr. Hitchcock, before we get into the papal term limits issue, just a few minutes ago during Open Lines, we had someone call in, and I was reading a Wall Street Journal piece about an Episcopal church that was giving communion to cats and dogs to bring people in. And someone called in and said, doesn't the Roman Catholic Church have a day or a rite for the blessing of animals, livestock, this kind of a thing that they've practiced for some time? Are you aware of anything like that?
I'm not aware of anything officially. I should say, first of all, certainly they don't give communion to animals. It often is done, but I'm not aware that it is officially part of the ritual of the Church. It would be more in the area of what I think one would call popular piety. But, you know, as a matter of fact, if I knew in advance, I would have checked with my wife, because she keeps up on liturgical matters a lot more than I do. But that would be offhand, my guess.
So this would be perhaps an individual priest,
right,
with his parish saying,
right,
we'll do something like this.
That's right. My impression.
Let's talk about an article that appeared in USA Today under the headline, How Long Is Too Long? Pope John Paul II's Failing Health Brings the Question of Term Limits to the Fore. This is the first time I've read of the question of term limits. We've talked with you about what do you do when a pope is incapacitated in office, but this is a different issue. Your reaction, general reaction, to the story itself?
I'd make a distinction, first of all, as to the story itself. I don't put much credence in it, because you look at some of the people being quoted. Father Richard McBrien of Notre Dame, there's an Australian priest in Rome, Father Gerald O'Collins. These are people who aren't very happy with the present pope, and who are very eager to say, therefore, gee, isn't it time that he should step down? The USA Today story has the earmarks to me of a kind of a planted story by people who have an agenda, and I wouldn't put too much credence in it. On the other hand, the issue itself, it seems to me, is a legitimate one. As we know, today it's not at all uncommon for people to live well into their 90s, and the ordinary retirement time in secular life is probably mid-60s. Bishops in the Catholic Church are supposed to retire when they're 75. So it seems to me it is a legitimate question. Can we expect that popes should go on forever?
Now, the present pope, if I'm not mistaken, is going to be 84 in just a couple months?
Yes, this year he'll be 84.
He is the second longest reigning pope in the history of the Roman Catholic Church. He is also, arguably, the most accomplished. Would you agree?
In many respects, I think he's certainly the greatest, you might say, the greatest intellect who's ever served on the papal throne. I mean, he's a theologian and a philosopher in his own right. He would be very important even if he were not pope. In terms of his actions as pope, I guess I would not put him in the absolute first rank in terms of the effects which he's had on the actual life of the Church. But I think in terms of a man of enormous gifts and enormous accomplishments, he's certainly up there.
Has John Paul II ever made any public statements as to his plans were he to be so infirm he couldn't carry out the duties of his office, or were he to be incapacitated in some other way?
Not to my knowledge. And apparently, as far as I can tell, there is no formal procedure for dealing with this. It would be a matter of the cardinals in Rome coming together and kind of agreeing among themselves the Pope can no longer function, and then whatever they would do next. Of course, it's a catch-22. If a Pope were mentally incompetent, then he couldn't really resign. So what would happen then? So I wouldn't doubt that there will be some thought given to procedures for the future. Now, the other side of it is this. John Paul is fairly weak physically, although from time to time he seems to rally. I don't think anybody says that he's losing it mentally. It's worth remembering that one of the popes who's had enormous effect in modern times, John the 23rd, was 77 when he was elected. At the time, everybody said, oh, a transitional pope. He remained in office for a little less than 6 years, as I remember, was about 83 then when he, or a little less than 5 years, was about 82 when he died. Great age doesn't necessarily mean that a man is incapable of carrying on his responsibilities. I mean, I know, for example, Father McBrien, I'm sure, is a great admirer of John the 23rd, and if you said to him, well, he should have never been pope, he was too old, Father McBrien would quickly deny that.
It seems as though McBrien, as he's quoted in the USA Today story, is more concerned, in his words, about one man putting too deep a stamp on the church and its leadership. What's that mean?
Well, I think that, again, it means the Pope, John Paul II, has an agenda which involves orthodoxy, a reaffirmation of Catholic tradition that Father McBrien doesn't agree with. I think, first of all, factually, it's exaggerated. People like Father McBrien would make John Paul II into a kind of a tyrant who has cloned himself and everybody comes out of the same cookie cutter. Absolutely not true. I mean, he's appointed any number of bishops and cardinals in the world who would have to be called liberal by Father McBrien's standards. If the Pope for the last 25 years had been following Father McBrien's agenda, I don't think he'd be complaining about his putting his stamp on the church. We're supposed to, of course, the church theoretically ought to be consistent. You know, it ought not to be going back and forth from one pope to another. It ought to be a consistent policy.
Well, and I don't want to sound facetious here, and I certainly do not intend to be, but when I read Father O'Brien's comments there about one man putting too deep a stamp on the leadership and the church itself, I had to ask, that one man is, in, at least according to the teaching of the church, as pope, when he speaks ex cathedra, speaking infallibly.
That's correct. I think Father McBrien would want to minimize that idea to the point almost of non-existence. Now, it's true that there are very few instances where the Pope, in a formal sense, claims to be speaking infallibly. But after all, one assumes the Pope is in tune with the authentic teachings of the Church, and especially this is true of a man of such great learning as John Paul II. So his many, many encyclicals and letters and public addresses and so on, which would not, strictly speaking, be considered infallible, I think nonetheless have to be considered an authoritative statement of Catholic doctrine.
We have talked about this before, but I'd like to walk back over this. There is a way of having a term limit without actually setting a term limit, and that is by electing the next pope, who would follow Pope John Paul II, a man of more advanced years, and that, to be quite frank, death would be the term limit there.
Yes, exactly. And that is what some people think they did in 1958 when they elected John the 23rd. We'll have a brief transitional pontificate. We'll all kind of catch our breath. Well, he turned out to be one of the most influential popes of modern times. The problem with that, of course, in the system, as you pointed out, is you may not have him in for an extremely long time, but if you elect a man who is 75, he could still live to be 95. So, I mean, that's, as I say, not at all unusual in modern times. So that doesn't exactly solve the problem either.
As you look at the, these things are, of course, just happenstance, but as you look at the history of the church, is it a, are pontificates largely short? Are, I know that this is unusually long, but are 20-year pontificates that unusual?
20 years, yes, fairly unusual. I don't know if anyone's ever broken it down statistically, but my offhand, the top of my head is averaged it out, you know, it would probably come to less than 10 years. There have been, of course, the most notable example being in our own memory, John Paul I, Pope for a month. And that has not been unknown in the history of the church. I would guess 6, 7, 8, 9 years might be something like an average.
Now, there's an interesting quote in the USA Today story from Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. He is Dean of the College of Cardinals. The story says he suggests that term limits may be in order in an interview last month with the magazine Christian Family. Ratzinger allowed that as people now live longer, quote, one would also consider new norms. Do you think he's necessarily advocating any kind of term limits for the papacy?
It's interesting that he would say that. Again, I think of it in terms of some kind of a trial balloon. I think what's interesting about his having said it is it means now there's somebody on the conservative side who's saying it and who has been closely aligned with John Paul II. And my guess is that a prominent cardinal in the Vatican saying such a thing, he's not just idly speculating, but it means that there has been some discussion about it, and maybe it's an idea. Let's put it out in public and see how people respond to it. So it does seem to me to indicate as though it's under discussion.
How likely is it for one reason or another that John Paul II would step down before he passes away?
Well, I tend to think that it is unlikely, but it's kind of hard to say. His health condition, of course, is somewhat ambiguous. Periodically, he begins to look terribly weak, and then it seems as though he rallies. And as I say, there doesn't seem to be any doubt that mentally he's perfectly alert. I think the real problem maybe with someone in that age is not that he's either mentally or physically incompetent, but that the absence of energy. You know, you get to be that old, can you still have the energy that's necessary to stay on top of all the problems? I wouldn't rule out as an absolute possibility. It is claimed that he's got Parkinson's disease, which we know eventually will incapacitate him, and I think it is possible that if he saw that that was about to happen, or his doctors predicted that it would, I think it's possible that he could resign, but although I think it's probably unlikely.
Finally, Dr. Hitchcock, and I only ask you this because you did predict on this program that Raymond Burke might be the next Archbishop of St. Louis, and you were absolutely right. Make a prediction for us, if you would, as to who might be the next pope.
Interesting. If I had to pick one man, I would say Cardinal Norberto Rivera, the Archbishop of Mexico City. So, remember, you heard it here first.
And we're talking then about a Western Hemisphere pope.
I think it makes a lot of sense to think that they may go to Latin America the next time. Now, it is true that one hears that the Italians are in effect saying, hey, you know, it's our turn again. But I think it makes a lot of sense to think that the next pope may be a Latin American. It's the most Catholic part of the globe. They've gone out of Italy. The next logical thing is to go out of Europe. And if they go out of Europe, Latin America would be the natural place to go.
And it certainly would jive with what is the general trend of Christianity becoming a kind of a more southern hemisphere, equatorial religion.
That's right. That's right.
Dr. James Hitchcock, thank you very much for being our guest.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. James Hitchcock is professor of history at St. Louis University. We were talking about an issue raised in the USA Today about papal term limits. For the remainder of this part of this hour and into the next, We're going to be talking with Uwe Simonetto. He's religion editor for United Press International. And then for the last 10 minutes of the program, we will be getting an update on gay marriage in San Francisco from Randy Thomason of the California Family Institute. Until then, Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, is our guest getting our religion roundup. Uwe, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Great to be back.
Uwe, you have written recently about what you call the logic of gay weddings.
Yes.
And give us the scenario you lay out early in that piece.
Well, the scenario is, you know, this is the product of discussions with pastors, rabbis, Muslim scholars, and others. And they said, you know, if these people say if anything is unnatural, as a marriage between people, or the two people of the same sex can happen, why not first do something that most, what earthly reason could there be other than obviously theological reasons, for example, allow polygamy, which is infinitely more natural and certainly certainly appeals much more to the ordinary guy's disposition. We're talking strictly now here, non-theological, okay? And then in the end, you know, a rabbi friend of mine, Orthodox rabbi, please, says, well, you know, why not just marry your dog? He loves you, you love him, so you love each other. And then, of course, you know, you have all this stuff bantering about the internet, which is a spoof, I'm quite sure. You know, two brothers coming in saying they want to get married, and then the registrar saying, well, you know, that's incest, isn't it? I mean, you know, no, not that you can breed. They said, no, we're not homosexual, we're not gay. I said, well, then you can't get married. He said, well, why do you have to be homosexual to get married if you're two men? We love each other, we're brothers, but we're not homosexual. Or then, the next thing, you know, two bisexual couples love each other crosswise, all four of them, they want to get married and make one happy foursome. It becomes absolutely absurd. Let me add something to this here. I happen to be in France right now in my French home, and I've just come back from a dinner where there were four of us. One was a Roman Catholic woman theologian. The other one was an architect, and the third was a Bourbon princess, and then there was I. And we discussed nothing else but this craze in San Francisco. And here are four of us, none of us anti-American, or, you know, actually all of us very pro-American and loving that country. And, you know, we just were stunned how a major power, a world power, can decline into decadence within a little over two centuries of existence. That is unique in world history.
Is that how it's being perceived?
Well, absolutely.
You think generally by the world, a decline into decadence?
Yeah, it's a world in decline into decadence, a much younger civilization. I mean, you have nuts like the Dutch, you know, who marry themselves, but I mean, everybody knows that they're a little off a little loopy, and or you know people like in Sweden and in the northern part of Norway, where they sit in the in utter darkness for 6 months. You have even Lutheran ministers marrying same-sex couples, but you wouldn't think that a brand new dynamic civilization that is still growing, that is just flexing its muscles, should decline to such level of decadence, which is precisely what destroyed the Roman Empire. I mean, it was that type of decadence that in the end destroyed it all. And you can read all this, of course, in Paul's epistle to the Romans.
Someone might say, look, the slippery slope argument that if we permit this, we're going to eventually be permitting polygamy and polyandry and incest and bestiality, formalizing those unions as well. Someone's going to say, look, those are simply absurd conclusions. No one wants to take it that far. But are those conclusions, no matter how absurd they appear to us at this point, are they to be ruled out given the logic of gay marriage?
I wouldn't. The logic is, look, we're living in a me society. Whatever gives you pleasure, or whatever you think gives you pleasure, because surely it can't give you pleasure. But anyway, if whatever you think gives you pleasure,
should be all right. And then, of course, I mean, you know, if I weren't a Christian, I mean, certainly there are plenty of beautiful women out there I would like to be married to. And then, of course, you know, so what do you do? You marry four women, as the Muslims do, or allowed to in their own religion. And then, of course, yeah, what is it going to do to the whole legal system? What is it going to do to your social security system? Who gets the pension? Who gets all this? Obviously, it would solve the unemployment problem in the United States, because everybody must become a divorce lawyer, because you have to divorce all these couples or these unions. But what is very troublesome, I mean, this is all jesting about, and some people take that more seriously than others. What is very troubling is what here in France, a Muslim scholar who is a moderate and who a very wise man says, you know, these guys are playing into the hands of the militant Islamists, because the Islamists, that's Osama bin Laden and his bunch and the slightly milder people, but nonetheless radical Muslims, they're not interested in the theological aspects of life. They're interested in imposing the Sharia law. And they say, well, look, if it's okay for homosexuals to get married, or men to get married, or women to get married, then surely we can raise our finger here and say, well, look, our religion tells us that we can have four wives if we treat them all equally well. So who are you to say we can't have this in Western society? And then you say, well, this is our law. Well, then they say, well, Christians living in Muslim societies have the dhimmi status. Dhimmi status is a sort of protected status where you have to pay extra tax, and then you can live according to your religion. So we demand the same. So then you're going to have, I'm not saying the majority of the Muslims, that would be ludicrous, but then you would have hardline Muslim, militant Muslim agitation in America and in Europe, demanding equal rights, and not just on that level, not just on the marriage level, on all sorts of other levels, which would not be commensurate with what we believe is a free society.
With only a minute here before we have to go to our first break here, Uwe, how is this decline into decadence being perceived by militant Islam in Islamic states, those who have no great love for the Western world or for American culture?
Well, they use this as they point at this as proof that Christianity is rotten to the core, and it only takes a tiny move to bring it down. And in other words, it's playing into the hands of terrorists. And that is precisely, by the way, what the Archbishop of Abuja in Nigeria is saying. You are actually killing Christians by this type of behavior.
Uwe Simonetto is our guest. When we come back, we'll have a few more minutes with him and continue our religion roundup. We'll be talking about some research from George Barna. He says that religious activity is increasing in the West. Is this all good news? What kind of religious activity is increasing, and what does it signal? We'll also be talking a little bit with Uwe, as time permits, about the legacy of the 1960s, the abuse in the Roman Catholic Church. Stay with us.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, etc.
St. Peter writes, Christ died for sins, once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God. This is the message of Scripture. This is the heart of the Christian faith. This is the truth that Christians, young and old, live by. Our Issues, etc. book of the month for March is called Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. This children's book tells the story of God's grace through Jesus Christ to St. Peter. You can order Follow Me by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. You can also browse before you buy. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find information on the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net.
1-800-325-3040.
Defending the Faith. Now, who can do it?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the effective witnessing book, Why Won't They Listen? Well, Ken, how do you teach others to better defend our Christian faith?
I was settling down for my two-hour flight heading for our next Answers in Genesis conference. I opened up my Creation magazine when the man next to me asked, "What are you reading?" Now, I just love it when people ask this question. It means I can give a creation seminar right there on the plane. I found out, though, that he was a Christian. He was intensely interested when I began talking about Genesis, dinosaurs, fossils, and so on. I spent considerable time explaining how all of our biblical doctrines are founded in Genesis. For instance, I demonstrated from the Bible that the doctrine of marriage was dependent on the literal events of Genesis. I showed him how the Apostle Paul used Genesis as the foundation to preaching the message of the cross. At the end of this two-hour discussion, the man said, "You know, I've been a Christian for many years, but I couldn't defend my faith. I sort of knew what I believed, but it was all floating out there somewhere. For the first time in my life, you've brought it all together because you've explained Genesis. Now I understand it." How can we defend our faith? We must understand that Genesis is true.
The message that the book of Genesis is accurate will be used by 100 Americans who will be sharing their faith at the Greek Olympics in August. Discover more about their plans when you go to AnswersRadio.com. While there, notice all of our free witnessing booklets. That's AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. I confess that I am no fan of heavy metal music, but some kids love this stuff. Research suggests that most children who listen to this kind of music soon get bored with it. However, studies also indicate that there is a small minority of teens who become immersed in this music and become absorbed by it. These are usually teens who have other serious problems. For these teens, this music can be very influential because it validates their self-destructive and immoral ideas. If your teen is listening to heavy metal music a lot, consider it a warning sign for other serious issues. It could even be a plea for help. Remember, our greatest help comes from Jesus Christ. He who died on Calvary's cross for you will help you and your child with any problem. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at www.cmli.org.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Wallace. Are you addicted to stress? Maybe even a stress junkie? Well, you might be if you're like a lot of women who are juggling a spouse, kids, job, and 100 other things, right? Hey, why not take a break and join me next time when clinical counselor Sally Oyster stops by to help us with damage control for stress and maybe even learn to have some fun again on the next Woman to Woman.
Saturday mornings at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back. 25 minutes left in this hour of Issues Etc., the final hour today, coming to you live Wednesday. It's March the 10th. Uwe Simonetto is our guest for the next few minutes, doing a bit of a religion roundup. And Uwe has been kind enough to join us from France, where he is on this occasion. And I think it's getting to be about 1 o'clock in the morning there in France. So, Uwe, thank you very much for your patience with us. You have written recently also about George Barna's recent discoveries in his research that spiritual activity, religious activity, is increasing in the West. What does this signal? What does Barna discover there?
Well, he discovered, for example, that within the last 10 years, individual Bible study has shot up quite significantly from 37% in 1994 to 44% this year. Participation in small groups for prayer, Bible study fellowship shot up from 11 to 26%, especially in the Western United States, and it doubled among men, which is quite remarkable. The same thing is true that individual prayers, for example, have gone up. But that does not mean that attendance at church has moved. That's still stagnant. So that's quite interesting.
Let's go to the phones and talk with Kathy. She's calling from St. Charles. Kathy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask, Uwe, I've talked about this with my son and my husband, about the acceleration of the decline of the American society being unprecedented in history. Would you say that the church has played a role in this acceleration, or do you know, been able to figure out the cause of the acceleration? Because unlike in the Middle Ages where the church influenced the culture, just, Martin Luther is an example of that during the Middle Ages. That was a positive influence with the Episcopal Church marrying people when it's not even recognized by a civil authority. It seems like it's having a negative effect.
Kathy, thank you very much for the question. You talked before about a decline into decadence, and you noted that.
Yes. The church is certainly participating in this decline, and it is, of course, also a symptom. One of the reasons why the church participated in the decline is, of course, when the church ceased to be, or many churches, many denominations, ceased to be teachers of Scripture and gave into the spirit of time. Of the time or the zeitgeist, which is really that the church has adopted secular values and secular interests and made them supersede spiritual interests. And of course, what you've seen in the Episcopal Church is one of the most pathetic developments: a proud church simply giving in to every fad there is. Of course, that isn't the entire church, but a significant part of that church, and it's being let down time and again, even by its spiritual leadership in England. Yes, the church has an enormous role, a responsibility here, and I'm quite sure will be judged accordingly.
Tying this into the research from Barna, it is also noted, I looked through this research, it seems as though what's really up is individualized, privatized religious activity rather than the kind of corporate religious activity. And you mentioned that church attendance is still stagnant. Is that part also of the church's contribution to this general decline?
I think so. When the church decides, look, let me give you an example. When the church says, for example, here's a nice easy chair, sit down and just listen, okay? And we won't trouble you with too much doctrine. We will not explain scripture too much to you. Just listen to it. These are good stories, and as long as you come, it's fine. Which you have in many of the mega churches. Then, of course, that leads to the decline. The church has somehow failed to grab people's curiosity about itself, saying, well, here's something you cling on to. Here's something that will guide you. If the church no longer provides any skeleton upon which you can build the body of society, then, of course, it is no longer interest. Now, there is still what St. Paul calls the thirst for God, and the thirst for God is manifest in this increase in prayer activity, but this is, of course, very postmodern because everybody is doing his own thing there. Or, for example, Bible study groups, which could also be group dynamics. I'm very leery of these developments because none of this indicates a sense of the church as the body of Christ, as the church as keeper of the sacraments. What we are one body. All these things do not take place there, and so therefore this whole thing can, of course, flip in the opposite direction whenever it suits. This is very postmodern.
The whole postmodern trend in the church, you've also written about the legacy of the 1960s, and in particular,
yes,
the possible connection between the changing of the Roman Catholic Church's thinking right around the time of Vatican II and what we saw in the 70s with the kind of the flourishing of these abuse cases that we were only now hearing the full extent of.
Yeah, well, look, let's not beat about the bush here. These abuse cases are all more than 80% homosexual in nature, and these guys were lusting after young male but sexually mature bodies. You know, these were adolescents. Very, very few of these were actual children. What happened in the 1960s? After Vatican II, mind you, a misinterpretation of Vatican II. So suddenly people said, you know, everything goes. I mean, Michael Rose, who wrote this marvelous book on Good Men, something where he described how the seminaries were infiltrated by the homosexual lobby, how teachers suddenly went absolutely wild. That is, you know, theology professors, priests went wild and had huge sexual affairs in seminaries. This is, you know, this is a tailspin. Mind you, this is over. We're talking about something in the past, but it obviously comes across now, and we suddenly find ourselves with a legacy of 4,000, God knows what, almost 5,000 priests having committed at least 11,000 sexual crimes with juveniles, adolescents, children, what have you, they had nicknames for seminaries like the Pink Palace. That was the Saint Mary Seminary in Baltimore. No longer that, but nonetheless, I mean, the legacy still remains. Cardinal Keeler has cleaned that one up. In Chicago, for example, a Lutheran professor at the Lutheran School, then Lutheran School of Theology, told me that at that time, we're talking about the sort of early 70s, the neighboring Catholic seminary was absolutely out of control. By comparison, the Lutheran students were absolutely benign and pious. They threw everything overboard that they had been taught. And that is the legacy we get. And this is 1960s stuff.
You've written also recently, and I just found this fascinating, Uwe, not so much a review of Mel Gibson's Passion film, but an observation about how odd it is that this film is successful, especially among American Protestants. Why did it strike you as odd?
Yeah, well, you know, here you go to these, we're not talking about Lutherans here, which probably is also the case, but we're talking about the kind of Protestants who barely have a cross in their sanctuaries, you know, and if there is a cross, it's certainly the empty cross, it's not a crucifix, who would not have any graven images in of anything. And they rush to see the one big icon of what I think is the 20th and 21st century, namely this particular film. It astonishes me. Well, it doesn't astonish me because I know that most people, most Christians of different persuasions are desperately worried about what is going on in the world, and here, you know, they cling on to Christ, and they go there, and they come out absolutely stunned. I wouldn't be surprised if, as a result of this, one of the many results of Mel Gibson's films, you'll find that evangelicals and other Protestants would be much less. Have had a few problems with having images of in their sanctuaries, maybe crucifixes. Maybe they should definitely have a crucifix there to see what Christ has actually suffered. They walk into these churches, they see the empty cross. The Anglican Church, which Kathy just mentioned, the Episcopal Church has the empty cross. Well, you have the empty cross, so you can bypass the suffering of Christ and go straight forward to the resurrection. Well, that's easy stuff. But the Catholics, the Orthodox, and the Lutherans have maintained that, you know, that Good Friday is the key day.
I wear a very large crucifix when I preach by invitation in the St. Louis area and elsewhere. And I am often approached by fellow Lutherans who are most often just curious, benignly curious, saying, I thought we Lutherans didn't use the crucifix. I thought that was a Roman Catholic thing.
Yeah.
What's the best response, to your way of thinking, to that, Uwe?
Well, the best response to it is that, well, there are two responses. One response is that when God created an icon of himself, namely in Christ, he allowed us to create icons, and then we show Christ. Number two, obviously we should not venerate or kneel and pray to the cross, but we pray to Christ. But nevertheless, keep this as an image before us to see what Christ, what God has done for us, which the empty cross does not show us, but the crucifix does. So these are the two key answers. And, of course, Luther said clearly, as long as this doesn't become become idolatry, that you actually pray to the image rather than to God himself, it's fine.
Uwe Simonetto, thank you for giving us your time, especially at the late hour at which you join us there in France. Thank you again.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye, Todd.
Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. We've got about 10 minutes left in this hour of Issues Etc., and that 10 minutes will be spent with Randy Thomason. He's executive director of Campaign for California Families, based in Sacramento, California. We're going to get an update on gay marriage in San Francisco. Randy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd, it's good to be with you.
Randy, how frustrating is it, as a Californian, to watch your Attorney General, Bill Lockyer, basically sit on his hands, given what's happening in San Francisco?
Well, it's very frustrating. You know, I was shocked by things that were done through the law for several years, where religious freedom and parental rights were just trampled by the homosexual and transsexual agenda, which is not tolerant of any ideas but its own. Now, I am shocked by lawmakers not even obeying the law, people who have no legislative power anymore, such as Bill Lockyer, who used to be a state Senate president in this state. He no longer has any right to do anything but enforce the law, yet he's not enforcing the law. He's not sending his Department of Justice investigators to San Francisco to basically take over that office and say this is against the law. He is not prosecuting Mayor Gavin Newsom and hitting him up with 3,800 criminal counts. So that's how many unlawful marriages have been performed. And you see very different scenarios in New York and New Jersey, where local law enforcement officials and in New Jersey, the state attorney general, saying, look, this has got to stop or else we're going to haul you into court. So Bill Lockyer is derelict of duty.
I want to talk about that duty. He is not only in violation of the Defense of Marriage Act that stands in California. He's not only in violation of the other laws there, but he's also violating, it through his inaction, it appears, his own job description. Give us the specifics, if you would, Randy.
Well, Bill Lockyer has a very clear job description as California's Attorney General for now 5.5 years. All he has to do to see what his job is look in the California State Constitution, Article 5, Section 13. And it very clearly says there that he is the chief law officer of the state. It says his constitutional duty is to enforce the law. And then it says very, very specifically that if a county disobeys the law, that the district attorney powers shall be for the state attorney general. In other words, I'll just quote it. Whenever, in the opinion of the attorney general, any law of the state is not being adequately enforced in any county, it shall be the duty of the attorney general to prosecute any violations of law, and in such cases, the attorney general shall have all the powers of a district attorney. And so, Todd, it's very clear. I mean, Bill Lockyer has, under pressure, admitted that the law is being broken. He knows that San Francisco is not enforcing the law, so now it falls upon him not to have the option, but to have the duty to prosecute those violations of law. Jason West of New Paltz, New Jersey, or New Paltz, New York, rather, who did 19 homosexual marriages in violation of law, was hauled into court, and he was hit with those. He was prosecuted. Why can't the Attorney General do it here in California? Because he doesn't want to. It's not that he can't. It's not that he shouldn't. It's not that it's not his duty. He just doesn't want to.
What can be done to deal with the Attorney General in California's inactivity here? Can the governor step in and do something about it?
I believe so. The governor has the constitutional duty to enforce the law, and it seems to me that if the Attorney General, who is subject to the governor, a lower position, if the lower guy's not doing it, then the top guy, Schwarzenegger, needs to enforce the law, which could be suing Bill Lockyer personally, sending the California CHP to the California Highway Patrol to San Francisco, sending in the state National Guard. Schwarzenegger, as governor, is in charge of the militia. We had a former governor, Ronald Reagan, who sent the state guard to UC Berkeley to quell some riots there in the late 60s. There's more that could be done. We're looking to who's going to enforce the law, and we see nobody enforcing the law who has the power to do so at this point.
What effect is this having, his inactivity in California, and what effect could it have in states, in other states besides California?
The reason that Oregon, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, is Washington State, is experiencing these local liberal politicians versus the state law on marriage is all because of San Francisco. San Francisco is not being punished. The law is not being enforced. It's copycat crimes that occur when the first public crime is not punished. How long has this been going on? Since February 12th. You know, that's been 4 long weeks now of utter blatant violation of the law, promoting counterfeit marriages, which are not worth what it's on there. Now, you've got a lot of people who claim the name of Christ, who listen to your station, right?
Yeah.
When we look at what Jesus said personally, when he said it in Matthew 18, he said, "In the beginning, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Therefore, what God has put together, let man not put asunder, or let man not separate." In one phrase, Jesus basically proclaimed marriage is for a man and a woman. Children need a mother and a father. Adultery is wrong, and divorce in most cases is wrong. And if you've seen the movie The Passion, you know all the suffering that he went through just for us. And it is something that we know from a moral standpoint is right. You know from a legal standpoint it's right, that marriage is only for a man and a woman. Tonight on 60 Minutes 2, I'll be on the program at 8 o'clock on the CBS station in your area, and I am going against the San Francisco mayor, and I said that there's five reasons why marriage is for a man and a woman only. It's the law, it's history and tradition, it's what's in the best interest of children, it's nature, and also the Bible. And all of these authorities agree, whether you agree with all the authorities, you have to agree with at least some of them, they agree that marriage is only for a man and a woman. If you don't have a man and a woman, you don't have marriage.
What concerns me the most, perhaps, Randy, is that there are those who have obtained some of those 3,800 illegal marriage licenses in San Francisco alone, who have obtained them solely for the purpose of carrying them to the various states and challenging the Defense of Marriage Act in those states.
Yes, again, copycat crimes. See, there's two parts of my heart which are very affected by this. One is marriage being assaulted. Two is the law being assaulted. And if the law can be broken for any reason, then this nation is sunk. And we have already seen San Francisco's philosophy all over the TV tubes. Now we saw, as of Friday, when San Francisco filed papers with the state Supreme Court, which is looking at this issue, San Francisco is actually claiming that politicians can break any law that they think is unconstitutional. It's a ridiculous claim.
Is that claim likely to hold up in any way with the state Supreme Court in California?
I sure hope not. I sure hope not. We have seen the state Supreme Court here in California harm religious freedom of Catholic charities by saying despite their religious views, they have to distribute contraceptives. Religious freedom is under assault, and I really believe that it's something that people in the church need to look at, because how can we expect there to be light in government and goodness in government if people who know what is good are not the main influence upon government? We have seen too many pastors dump out and want to please man rather than please God, who don't talk about these issues, who say, oh, we just got to do the gospel. Well, excuse me, Matthew 28, Jesus said, baptize them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And then he says, and teach them everything I have commanded. Well, in the first part of this interview, we said what Jesus commanded, that marriage ought to be for a man and a woman. The Apostle Paul backs that up in Hebrews, where he says, let marriage be honored by everyone. We've got to have people who know what is right be out there in leading, calling to lobby politicians and electing the right kind of judges and politicians in the first place. We are only to blame by looking at ourselves in the mirror, saying it's our inaction that this is happening. I really feel strongly about that. Darkness is nothing more than the absence of light.
Randy, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Great. You can actually contact Bill Lockyer, our Attorney General, by visiting our website, SaveCalifornia.com. We have lots of action alerts so you can get involved. We're trying to protect America from California.
Randy Thomason is Executive Director for Campaign for California Families, based in Sacramento, California. You can check out that website, SaveCalifornia.com, SaveCalifornia.com, or you can also call them at area code 916-443-1410. That's 916-443-1410. You know, this is a time when being a Christian does inform how you vote, how you think, what you do. But this is not a Christian-only issue, folks. This is the kind of issue that ought to be basic to any right-thinking citizen in America. And it's actually the kind of thing that Christians and non-Christians can agree on, even if they don't agree on all the reasons why the law shouldn't be broken in California, the Constitution shouldn't be challenged that way, and people should obey the law. Even if they don't agree on all the reasons, they should agree. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.